108 minutes.
I mean, that's basically the runtime of a decent movie.
It really is. But unfortunately for anyone trying to get to bed early on a Tuesday, that was the actual length of President Trump's State of the Union address last night.
February 24th, 2026.
Exactly. 108 minutes, the longest in modern history. And look, if you're listening to this deep dive, you probably saw the headlines. Maybe you caught a clip or two on social media, or maybe you're just a glutton for punishment and watched the whole raw feed on C-SPAN.
Hey, if you did, kudos to your stamina.
Seriously. But whether you watched it or just heard about it, our job today is to take that absolute marathon, strip away all the applause breaks, and there were a lot of them, and really figure out what happened.
Right.
So we've combed through a whole stack of sources for you. We've got the raw C-SPAN feed, the domestic analysis from PBS News and the New York Times. We've got some global perspectives from the BBC and Al Jazeera, and we're looking at the weekly takes from Newsweek and Time.
And honestly, we really need that wide net because this just wasn't a normal speech.
No, it wasn't.
Usually, by the time a president hits the second year of a second term, things get, I don't say boring, but they get efficient.
Routine.
Yeah, routine.
Yeah.
You list your wins, you ask Congress for money, and you go home.
Right, but last night went in the exact opposite direction.
Completely. It was bloated, it was highly combative, and as Newsweek pointed out, it was incredibly theatrical,
Yeah.
but the length itself isn't the real story here. The
Yeah.
story is what he was trying to hide with that length.
And that is exactly the mission for this deep dive. We're going to look at the noise, the shouting, the medals, the hockey team, but we're also going to look at the silence.
The gaping holes.
Right, because for a guy who spoke for nearly 2 hours, there were some massive holes in the narrative regarding the Supreme Court and immigration.
It's a classic misdirection strategy. Look at the shiny object over here so you don't notice the foundational cracks over there.
So let's start with the shiny object, the actual vibe inside the chamber. I was watching the C-SPAN feed, and usually you expect that whole partisan stand-up, sit-down aerobics routine.
Sure, that's standard.
Right, but this felt completely different.
It was a rally. I mean, that's really the only way to describe it.
Yeah.
You had the Republican side of the aisle absolutely raucous. Newsweek literally called it wall-to-wall noise.
While the Democratic side was just sitting in stone-cold silence.
Exactly. But honestly, that polarization isn't even new. What was new was how the president treated the chamber itself.
You're talking about the ceremony right in the middle of the speech.
Yes, breaking tradition is one thing, but this was rewriting the entire format of the event. He didn't just acknowledge guests up in the gallery like presidents usually do. He turned the floor of the house into a literal stage.
Yeah.
He brought the U.S. Olympic men's hockey team down, which, okay, great photo op. But then he actually bestowed presidential medals of freedom to war heroes in real time during the address.
See, I actually paused on that. Because on the surface, it seems fine, right? Honoring veterans is good politics. It's highly patriotic.
Of course.
So why is the New York Times analysis acting like this is some sort of constitutional crisis?
Well, because context matters. The State of the Union is, constitutionally speaking, a report given to the legislature. It's the executive branch visiting the people's house to report on the status of the nation.
Right. He's a guest.
Exactly. So by turning it into a live awards ceremony hosted by him, he's visually flipping that power dynamic. He isn't a guest reporting to Congress anymore. He's the master of ceremonies.
Which completely sidelines all the people sitting behind him.
Precisely. It turns the Speaker of the House and the Vice President into background extras on his set. And the Times analysis suggests this wasn't accidental at all. It aligns perfectly with how he's been governing lately.
Bypassing Congress.
Right. Relying on executive orders and essentially setting the visual message of, I am the source of action here, not these people in the seats.
So all the theatrics are basically a giant power flex.
100%. It's a visual assertion of dominance over the legislative branch.
Yeah.
And frankly, it's just smart theater.
Yeah.
If you can't get a bill passed, put on a show.
Well, speaking of bills, let's pivot to the substance, or at least what was billed as substance last night, the economy. Because this was definitely the loudest part of the night. He called it a turnaround for the ages.
Energy dominance. That was the phrase you just kept repeating.
Right. And he kept referencing this One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which I have to say, the branding is impeccable.
No, very catchy.
But what is actually in this bill? Because listening to him, he made it sound like it solves everything from high gas prices to world peace.
Well, we dug into the actual text via the PBS News analysis, and
Yeah.
it's essentially a massive omnibus deregulation package. The One Big Beautiful Bill is designed to strip away federal oversight on energy projects.
Okay.
It mandates lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico that had previously been paused. It opens up sections of the Arctic for drilling. And crucially, it puts a hard cap on the timeline for any environmental reviews.
So it's basically a drill baby drill law.
It is. And his core argument is simple. You unleash American energy, supply goes way up, and inflation comes down.
Yeah.
And he spent a solid 20 minutes just reading off stats about plummeting inflation numbers to prove that it's working.
Here is the rub, though. And both the New York Times and Newsweek highlighted this massive disconnect in their coverage. If the macro numbers are so fantastic, why is the sour public sentiment still hovering near all-time lows?
Because of the cumulative effect. And this is something independent economists were shouting about in the Al Jazeera coverage. The president is actually right that the rate of inflation has dropped significantly.
Right.
Prices aren't rising as fast as they were 2 years ago.
But they aren't going down.
Exactly. Unless you have outright deflation, which is a whole other economic nightmare, prices just stay at that new higher plateau.
Mm.
So the president is up there celebrating that the car has stopped speeding up, but the voters are still mad that they're driving 100 miles an hour.
That is a really great analogy. So he's saying, look at the chart, and the average voter is saying, look at my grocery bill.
And that friction is incredibly dangerous for him politically.
Mm-hmm.
Al Jazeera actually fact-checked his specific claim about record low gas prices from the speech.
Let me guess, record low comes with a massive asterisk.
A huge asterisk. They found that while prices at the pump are down from their peak, they are nowhere near historical lows when you adjust for purchasing power.
Wow.
Plus, those EPA rollbacks we talked about in the One Big Beautiful Bill, they are mobilizing the opposition. You have environmental groups suing. You have states like California threatening their own countermeasures. It's just messy.
So taking an economic victory lap right now is a bit premature.
It's not just premature. It's a gamble. Mm-hmm. He's betting that by the midterms in November, the drill policy will actually lower the price at the pump enough to make people forget the last 3 years of compounding inflation.
Okay, so that was the loud part of the speech, the roaring economy, the energy dominance. But I really want to get to the silence.
The missing pieces.
Right. Because for a president who literally built his entire political identity on immigration, you know, the wall, the borders, aggressive enforcement, it was shockingly quiet last night.
Honestly, this was the biggest surprise for me in the entire stack of sources. PBS News actually timed it. In a 108-minute speech, immigration got scant mention.
Really?
Yeah. He hit the standard buzzwords, sure, secure border, mass removals. But he moved on almost immediately. There were no long, improvised stories about the Border Patrol, no graphic descriptions of crime like we're used to hearing.
Why do you think that is? Is the problem solved in his eyes?
Far from it. But the politics of it have shifted dramatically. PBS suggests that polling on aggressive enforcement is slipping. The public is getting fatigued by the rhetoric.
Uh-huh.
But Al Jazeera highlighted a very specific incident that provides a much darker context for this sudden silence.
You're talking about the raid in Minnesota.
Yes. This happened just about 3 weeks ago. It was a massive enforcement operation targeting a factory up in Minnesota.
Right.
Pretty standard procedure for this administration on paper.
Right.
But in the chaos of the raid, two people died.
And these weren't undocumented immigrants.
No. They were U.S. citizens, bystanders, who just got caught in the crossfire of a highly militarized police action.
See, that changes the calculus completely.
It changes everything. When an aggressive enforcement policy leads directly to the deaths of American citizens on American soil, you lose the moral high ground instantly. The administration knows this is a huge vulnerability. They are currently under federal investigation for that exact raid.
So standing up and talking about aggressive enforcement on national TV right now
would just remind everyone of Minnesota. It would remind those crucial suburban voters, the ones he desperately needs for the 2026 midterms, that mass removals can be messy, they can be violent, and they can be dangerous for everyone, not just the people being targeted.
That is really heavy, but it completely explains why he wanted to spend time talking about hockey medals instead.
It's classic damage control by omission. If you just don't talk about it, maybe the news cycle moves on.
But there was another massive elephant in the room that he couldn't just ignore, even though he really tried to gloss over it. The Supreme Court.
Ah, yes. The tariff ruling.
We need to dig into this because I feel like this got buried in the headlines with all the pageantry. The Supreme Court, which is a court with a strong conservative majority, literally just struck down his signature global tariff policy. What exactly happened there?
This is a huge deal, and it really undercuts that whole piece through strength and dominance narrative he was pushing. Essentially, the president tried to impose a blanket 20% tariff on almost all imports.
20%?
Yeah, massive. And he cited national security as the justification. He used a very, very broad interpretation of trade laws to just push it through without asking Congress.
And the court said no.
The court said absolutely not. The ruling, which PBS analyzed in depth, basically reaffirmed that the power of the purse, and that specifically includes tariffs, belongs to Congress, not the king. The opinion bluntly stated that national security cannot be used as a blank check by the executive branch to just rewrite the entire U.S. tax code.
That has to sting. I mean, this is supposed to be his court, theoretically.
That's the irony of the whole thing. These are conservative judges. They are strict constitutionalists. They looked at the separation of powers and decided the executive branch was severely overreaching.
So if you tie this back to the speech last night, you have a president standing there telling the world he is the ultimate authority, energy dominance, American resurgence.
Yeah.
But just days before, the court basically slapped his hand and said, you actually can't do that.
Right. It created this incredibly awkward undertone to the whole evening. He's projecting total control, but legally speaking, he's just been put in check.
Did he mention it at all?
He didn't mention the ruling directly. He knows better than to pick a fight with the Supreme Court on live TV when he's already losing. But he doubled down hard on the rhetoric of protectionism. He kept saying, we will protect our industries, even though the primary legal mechanism he wanted to use to do that has just been taken away.
It feels like he's fighting a war on two fronts here. He's bypassing Congress with all these theatrics because he can't pass laws easily. And now he's hitting a brick wall with the courts on his executive actions.
Which leaves him with very few options.
Yeah.
If you can't legislate and you can't govern by decree, what's left?
The show.
Exactly. The show becomes the policy.
Let's zoom out to the rest of the world for a second. Because while he's fighting the courts at home, he's trying to project this image of peace through strength abroad. And the BBC focused heavily on this doctrine.
It's basically the Reagan doctrine, just recycled. But the actual application of it is pretty messy. The foreign policy focus was heavily on Iran.
He brought up the 2026 Iran massacres.
He did. And that was a very significant moment. By formally acknowledging those massacres in the State of the Union, he's elevating the tension globally.
Mm.
He warned about their missile capabilities in very stark terms.
Right.
But the media critiques, especially from the BBC, noted that for all the tough talk, there really is no clear strategy presented. Is he proposing more sanctions, airstrikes, an actual invasion?
It was left completely vague.
Intentionally vague. We are watching. We are ready. That kind of language. It keeps the adversary guessing, sure, but it also keeps the American public totally in the dark.
He also mentioned Ukraine, just saying the administration is working hard to end the war, but again, super light on details.
Very light.
But he did get extremely specific about one military action, the drug boats.
The drug boats, yes. This was, well, unexpected. He openly bragged about using missile strikes to take out drug trafficking vessels in international waters.
Is that normal?
No. It is absolutely not normal. Usually, drug interdiction is strictly a law enforcement issue. You use the Coast Guard, the DEA, using military-grade missile strikes against smugglers. That raises massive, massive questions about international law.
I can imagine.
The BBC pointed out that while this plays really well domestically, because it looks like tough action against the drug crisis, it sets a wild precedent globally. Are we now in a hot war with cartels? Does the authorization for use of military force suddenly cover a guy on a speedboat with bricks of cocaine?
It totally blurs the line between police work and warfare.
Completely. And it feeds right back into that royal decree theme we were talking about. He's using the military as a hammer for a problem that usually requires a scalpel. Looks incredibly strong on TV,
mm-hmm.
but the legal and diplomatic fallout of that is wildly complex.
And the rest of the world is watching all of this. What was the global takeaway from the BBC and Al Jazeera?
I think the BBC captured it best. He stood up there at the podium and declared that America is respected again. But the camera cuts continually showed a room divided perfectly in half, one side cheering wildly, one side dead silent.
Yeah.
The world sees that split screen. They see a president who claims to command absolute respect globally, but can't even get the opposition party in his own country to stand up for him.
It's really hard to sell national unity when your own house looks like a divorce court.
Peace through strength abroad. But gridlock and silence at home.
So let's wrap this up. We've unpacked the 108 minutes. We've seen the showmanship with the medals, the shaky economic claims on inflation, the glaring silence on the Minnesota tragedy, and of course, that looming legal battle with the Supreme Court. When you step back and look at all these sources, what actually is the state of the union now?
I think we are witnessing a fundamental shift in the very purpose of this speech. The New York Times touched on it, but I really want to push their analysis further. Traditionally, historically, the State of the Union is a request. The president goes to Congress to ask for partnership. Please pass this budget. Please approve this treaty. Let's work together.
Right.
But because of the deep gridlock, and specifically because of this president's governing style, that era is over.
It's no longer a request.
It's a status report. Or honestly, even a shiver of defiance. He's not there to ask Congress for anything anymore. He's there to tell them and the cameras what he's doing despite them. He's saying, I will use executive orders. I will use the military on drug boats. I will hold my own medal ceremonies on your floor. You are just the backdrop.
Which brings up a fascinating thought for you listening. With the Supreme Court striking down his global tariffs just days prior, is that unilateral strategy finally hitting a ceiling?
And that is the defining question for the next 2 years as we head toward the midterms. He can ignore Congress, but he can't ignore the Constitution forever. The court just proved that. So we are heading into a very volatile period where the show runs headfirst into the law.
And we'll definitely be watching to see who blinks first.
We certainly will.
All right, that is a wrap on this deep dive. We took you through the 108-minute marathon in just under 20. If you want to dive into the specific text of that one big, beautiful bill act, or read the full Al Jazeera fact check on the gas prices, we've got all those links for you in the show notes.
Always read the fine print, folks.
Always. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.